Welcome to This Is Money podcast, brought to you in partnership with Charles Stanley Direct, the award-winning investment platform trusted by over 40,000 clients. Investment involves risk. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, furlough mark two, or too little, too late to save millions of jobs. The Chancellor gave us his winter economy plan to help businesses in the wake of tighter restrictions to stop the spread of coronavirus. But what's in it and will it work? And how much more are we going to have to fork out in tax to pay for all this? Huge cuts announced at NS&I, which could see you earn just a quid on every 10,000 you stash away. Where on earth can its millions of savers turn to now? Also, it's not just government measures to stop coronavirus that's playing Scrooge this year. Could an import-export crisis sink Christmas too? Is the end of the loyalty penalty finally in sight? And all good things come to an end. We discuss the hot tub hangover. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app at first. Despite repeated calls to extend the furlough scheme, the Chancellor has held firm. However, as a result of increasingly tighter restrictions from his boss that we got over the last couple of weeks to stop the spread of coronavirus, Rishi had to act. Out was the autumn budget, but in came the winter economy plan. Not so much a plan, perhaps, as just a few ideas, one of which was a sort of furlough light aimed at replacing the old scheme when that comes to an end on the 31st of October. Will the job support scheme, though, be enough to support jobs? And what else is in there? Firstly, Simon, the mood music has changed. This was about saving, and the Chancellor said it, viable jobs. And that we're in this as well, if you don't have to read between the lines, we're in this for a good while yet. Tell us about the context of the plan first, and then we'll get into the detail.
The context of the plan is that despite the measures that were announced this week feeling something like an inevitable crawl towards the pain of full lockdown that we had earlier this year. And they were pretty depressing, although I think only alleviated by the fact that we didn't go into full lockdown. It could have been worse. You could be in Scotland. And they didn't ban us seeing other households, which I think is a measure that while a lot of people are calling for, they need to reflect on the severe damage to people's mental health and sort of quality of life that brings. That was one of the most painful things about lockdown, and it's really bad for people who live by themselves, or for the elderly who might be by themselves. And as a parent, I can tell you that it's absolutely awful for children not to be able to see their friends or their cousins and things like that. And it's bad as a parent as well, because you need that sort of letting off steam safety valve of seeing other people, being stuck at home, just you, your partner and your kids. It's quite tough, but we didn't get that. What we got was this sort of hybrid version of near lockdown. And what you can see if you really dig into it is that they've tried to allow stuff that is economic activity whilst trying to minimize that, hence slightly strange ideas around closing pubs at 10 o'clock rather than, you know, whenever they close. But, you know, you've got to, as someone said the other day, yeah, they might seem illogical, but all of these measures will seem illogical. But you just, it's about kind of like squeezing stuff where you can, but still allowing people to do things. So, for example, restaurants and pubs can stay open. Lots of businesses can stay open, whereas before they were basically told to shut. People have been told to work from home again, although there's definitely a little bit more wiggle room on that one than there was before. And the mood music is a bit different this time from the government, but the mood music is a bit different this time from the public as well, who largely went along with the stay at home, don't do anything message last time round. And so whereas the furlough scheme, which was brought in to try and make sure that whilst we pushed the big pause button on the economy, there wasn't this sudden wave of jobs being lost because ultimately businesses were being told to shut, so therefore they didn't need their staff. If they keep paying their staff whilst they're shut, they probably go bust. So they were just going to have to get rid of the staff. The government said, well, look, we'll do you a deal. You shut, you keep your staff at home, you guys stay at home, we'll pay you. And the furlough scheme paid 80% of people's wages up to a maximum of £2,500 a month or £30,000 a year. This scheme is different because when furlough was brought in, we were paying people not to work. Now we are paying people with a direct link to actually working. The government did change it to introduce an element of part-time working when they started getting employers to pay, because they wanted to try to get employers to start picking up some of the bill. The big risk here now is that a lot of those industries that have been hit really hard by this, even though they're not being told to shut now, will be looking at it. They'll be looking at the uncertainty. They'll be looking at all those people that they had furloughed. Yep. And they'll be saying, when's this going to stop? We're just going to have to get rid of these people. We can't continue on. We've already seen a big, big wave of job losses, but that's nothing compared to what we potentially could see. And so a new plan had to be come up with, because the alternative was you just continue with furlough. And the new plan was to encourage companies to keep their staff on, to get them to do reduced hours. So they have to do at least 33% of their hours, a third of their hours. And as part of that deal, the government will pick up some of their wages. The company will still have to pick up some of their wages, but the government will pick up some of their wages. And so whereas under furlough, someone could get a maximum of 80%, under this, it seems people can get a maximum of 77%. Although, strangely, I heard the 80% figure bandied around yesterday as well. But the way it works is that to be eligible, employees must work at least a third of their normal hours. Employers will continue to pay staff for those hours they work. So for that third of their hours, their employer pays them. For the 67% of the hours that they're not working, the remaining hours, the government and the employer will each pay one third of the salary that they would have normally got. So the employee loses a third of their pay, but only loses a third of two thirds of their pay. Mm-hmm. The way the maths works is that an employee working 33% of their normal hours will receive up to 77% of their normal salary. Yeah. 55% of that gets picked up by the employer. So the employer is still picking up the lion's share and the state picks up 22%. However, the state's contribution will be capped at just below £700 per employee per month. And that figure does actually make this slightly more generous in terms of the sort of the salary level whereby you wouldn't, where you'd get the maximum government help than the furlough scheme, but not really a huge difference. So the idea is basically, can we keep people in their jobs and doing at least some work? And the government will reward companies for doing that by helping out with the wage bill. But companies will still have to pay people. And as this is actually linked to people being in jobs, hopefully it will stall some of those job losses, and maybe in this magical 6 months time, when everything can start to get better again,
we can get
back up and running. Because actually, funnily enough, until the stuff that we've seen over the past couple of weeks, despite being extremely dubious about this whole V-shaped recovery idea, I was seeing quite a lot of stuff that maybe made me think that stuff was going to come back a lot better than people thought. And then it stopped.
So there were other measures that were introduced, and we'll get onto those in a short while, because it's not all about this job support scheme. But the mood music, as I mentioned earlier, was about the viability of jobs. That's why you have to be working to get this money. But also, this is in for the long term. So the repayment of loans from 6 to 10 years. I'm not suggesting this is going to go on for 10 years, but actually the recovery and how we're going to pay for this, which we'll get onto in a minute, will probably last a lot longer than that. But what worries me with this is that why as a business would you, and we've said the same thing with that £1,000 that each company will get for bringing people back off furlough, why would you wait 6 months to get £1,000? Why would you, if you think this is going to go on for 6 months at least, risk paying 55% of a worker's salary who can only work a third of the hours? Obviously, they can work more than that. But why would you be paying that amount of money? Viable jobs, yes, but also a lot of decisions, perhaps small companies might be thinking, do you know what, maybe this isn't viable for me, and prematurely shut down and therefore lose loads of jobs that way. I'm just not convinced that businesses will view this as a sweetener. And this isn't available really for the big businesses, is it?
Well, it is available for big business, but there's qualifiers involved in that. So small and medium-sized businesses, which will cover a lot of the hospitality businesses that are hit very, very hard from this and don't have maybe the firepower or the reserves to completely withstand it. They don't have any kind of means test. If you're a large business, then you have to show that your turnover has fallen as a result of coronavirus. A lot of large businesses will be able to show that. You know, there are some businesses that have done better off the back of it. And there was a big question about some of them to do with the furlough scheme, etc. And we saw a lot of companies hand back furlough money, actually, who, you know, things were better than they expected and they handed back their furlough cash. Yeah, this is a totally, you know, viable question for a policy about viable jobs. Why would you do this?
You know, why if you keep were a company, permanent staff? Why wouldn't you just get freelancers in who could do the whole job and you pay them for the hours that they work? Why keep hold of your staff now?
Well, you could do, but then there is a scenario where obviously getting rid of people costs money as well. You do need to, you know, there are redundancy payments. Most companies will make some statutory redundancy, but most companies will actually have a slightly more generous redundancy scheme than that. You have to pay out people's notice. And also there's, you know, a duty of care to your staff. Many employers, you know, ultimately, it feels very harsh to people when they lose their jobs. And anybody who's lost their job will probably be thinking, well, my employer didn't show much duty of care to me. But employers do think very, very carefully about this kind of stuff before they, you know, before they cut jobs. And they don't want to cut jobs. And they'll do anything they can to try, many employers will do anything they can to try to avoid cutting jobs. So it provides an added incentive not to do so. I highly doubt it will work anywhere near as well as furlough to protect jobs and keep people in jobs. And I don't think Rishi Sunak thinks it will either, because he was quite clearly talking yesterday about just trying to keep some people in the viable jobs. But as an employer, the reason why you would do this is because you're keeping on a member of staff, quite possibly a valued member of staff, who has expertise and knowledge and knows your way of working and has been valuable to your business in the past. Through no fault of that employee and through no fault of your own, you have found your business unable to operate properly. But you think that actually, when these restrictions are lifted, we could operate properly. And actually, maybe there'll be a wave of people eager to come back and use our business. Look at the, you know, pubs and restaurants. Many of them were doing pretty well, actually, until fairly recently, after the restrictions had been lifted. So you might think, well, I don't want to have to, you know, find new staff, retrain them, build up that expertise, build up that knowledge, all that kind of stuff. And for some jobs, it might be quite specialised. So actually, I'd be better off trying to keep this person on. And this isn't, you know, a completely out of the hat kind of scheme that's been cooked up here. It's similar to schemes that have been done elsewhere. Germany was presented as an example. So, you know, maybe it might work. Just to say one other thing is that actually, if you look back to the sort of crash after the financial crisis, there was expected to be much, much higher levels of unemployment, and actually less companies made people redundant and unemployed than was thought. And there was a lot of things like shorter hours, compressed hours, you know, reduced wages and things like that to try and keep people in jobs. So maybe he's hoping that the companies will do that again.
Lee, I was going to ask you whether you think he should have extended furlough or perhaps given it, made it more targeted. But I also want to throw in, because Simon gave me a curveball there, we have touched on it in the past, but is it a fair comparison when we talk about what happened in 2008 to now? Because I was reading an article about how actually there's optimism about the amount we're going to be spending at Christmas, because after 2008, we still love to buy turkeys and wreaths and all the things that we buy at Christmas. But actually, is the comparison valid?
I think it's hard to sort of justify it at the moment because of all of the doom and gloom that we're hearing. You know, things like this is going to be one of the worst recession for hundreds of years, let alone the financial crisis. And then we're shown sort of graphs and things that, you know, we see a big red line go into areas that we've never seen before, mm-hmm. you know, diving down. And it's very difficult to say, yes, it's going to have a direct comparison to the financial crisis. We can look back perhaps in a year's time and decide that. I think in terms of this compared to furlough, you know, this could cost up to £9 billion over the next 6 months. When I heard that figure, I thought, wow, that doesn't sound like much, which is absolute madness now, George, isn't it? Yeah. Just the odd £9 billion.
We've already spent £40 billion, is that right, so far on furlough?
That's what I mean. So, you know, furlough at the moment is costing it's going to cost far much more than that over the period of six months. So £9 billion actually in the grand scheme of things doesn't sound like very much at the moment, which I just madness to say. And actually there's an article this morning from comments from the next boss, Lord Wilson, saying that Britain's economy risks becoming hooked on government handouts, which begs the question, and this is what goes around in my mind all the time, George, and has been for the last few months, and I know you know this, but it's how we're going to pay for this bill. And obviously Rishi Sunak, he's been impressive, Georgie. He's been one of the senior politicians that have actually, I think, come out of this with probably a better reputation or bigger reputation than at the start of the coronavirus. There's been far more losers than winners, I would suggest, in that arena when it comes to sort of senior politicians. But it's just is it going to take a generation to pay off this big bill that we're racking up? But look, it's difficult to sort of criticise, and you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. You know, if the government didn't act with some sort of scheme that's going to try and stem, you know, horrific job losses that are on the horizon, then they'll be dragged over hot coals. But then, you know, they announce a scheme and then, you know, some sectors say it's not gone far enough. So it's a real difficult fine balance, isn't it? I mean, I wouldn't fancy that job at the moment. I think being the Chancellor quite possibly is the most difficult job in Britain at the moment. I really, really...
And it's such a changing situation. He's responding to a virus, and let's be honest, no one knows what's going to happen there, and to a government which is changing policy and restrictions, and let's be honest, no one knows what's ever going to happen there either. So we don't know. I mean, we talk about this mythical 6 month period that this might be over, and we have absolutely no idea. But the problem that I have is, where is the planning, the proper planning? I mean, I call this a winter plan, the winter economy plan. I mean, it's not, it's a couple of measures that will get us through maybe the next 6 months. And what beyond there?
Well, that's it. There's going to be no budget, Georgie. That's what we heard in this. So this is kind of what we're going to get for the rest of the year, really. And you say about the planning, it's kind of the time frame of this, the way this virus is sort of, you know, happening. I think that, you know, it's difficult to put through too many measures all at once. I think you have to kind of look at it and see and adapt as it adapts. So I would say in the last, 2 to 3 months, I feel like there's been a kind of wave of more positivity. I feel like the summer was around, we were able to get out a bit more, we were able to spend maybe some of that money that we'd managed to stick away for a few months because we've been trapped indoors. So we had almost like, it wasn't a feel-good summer because the virus was always lurking in the background and everyone's thinking winter's going to come and it's all going to kick off again. Let's have fun while we can. So I think we've all been a little bit kind of, not blasé, because that's not the right word. We had a couple of months of lockdown where I think most people stuck to the rules and kind of like, yeah, got to take one for the team, got to stick by the rules. And we've had a kind of summer where we've all sort of maybe spent a bit more and had a bit more fun, and we've kind of tricked ourselves into going, oh, it's all back to normal now, everything's okay. And then all of a sudden, this sort of like last week to 10 days, we've just been absolutely walloped with, you know, the number of virus cases that have increased. And now all of a sudden people are going, oh, is there going to be a lockdown too? And people are starting to get fearful again. And it's kind of like, how do you plan for that? What else can the Chancellor do is what I'm trying to say. You know, of course there's pockets of, you know, self-employed, for example, that are unhappy with the measures that have not come in place for them. And it's very hard, you know, to sit here and say, you know, why wasn't there any measures put in place, you know, or better measures put in place for them? You know, there's all sorts of sectors and areas, and it's so tricky, Georgie. In my mind, it's so tricky. I really don't know where else the Chancellor could go.
It is, but I do wonder, what have they been doing? I mean, we've been seeing, we keep talking about we're following cases in Spain. I don't want to go too far down this route, Spain and France. But you know, if you think that we shut down the borders to Spain really effectively in the 25th of July, that's a fair old whack of time, which we've had to really think about what's going to happen next. Shouldn't we have a plan A, B, C, D, E? I mean, I don't know. And I have huge amount of sympathy. Don't get me wrong. This is a changing situation. But we also need to have some sort of an avenue, a way, a plan for not just the immediate, but for the longer term future, or at least understand what that could look like. Simon, Lee spoke there about the self-employed. We'll get to how we might pay for this shortly. I know we've discussed about it in the past, but we did get some intimations from the Chancellor that taxes would rise, as we imagine they would do. But before we get that, I do want to talk about that gap for the self-employed, because that is one thing that the Chancellor's had plenty of time with which to fix. Those 2.5 million people, perhaps, I think it was, that fell through the nets of the last scheme, the Self-Employment Income Support Scheme. We've got an extension of that. It's much less generous this time around, but surely it doesn't plug those holes. So what else is in there for those people, like company directors, pay themselves dividends, that earn over 50,000? What help is available for those people?
Well, it's interesting, the old self-employed thing. It has been repeatedly pointed out to Rishi that he has left a big chunk of people without any help, many of whom have lost a large amount of money without the safety net that employment offers them. And whilst he brought out these grants for the self-employed, which gave them a certain chunk of money, there were restrictions on it, which I think were designed to, because of this perception that lots of self-employed people are just doing that way so they can dodge lots of tax, and actually there's loads of really high earners just disguising income as it. Mm-hmm. But the most curious of these, and perhaps the one that's not commented on as much as the limited company director element, because a lot of people work as limited company directors, and there's quite a strong kind of lobby group going on there because there's been tax issues in the past and stuff, is the sole traders who've earned more than £50,000 a year. Now, if you're a sole trader, you can't pay yourself in dividends. You don't do any of that stuff that you hear about all the time, that, you know, the self-employed get accused of. And whilst people will say, oh, yeah, but they probably underreport their income and they pay less tax than they can do and everything like that. Well, actually, if they've been declaring profits of more than £50,000, they've been obviously declaring quite a lot of income and they've been paying quite a lot of tax on it. And bizarrely, if you have earned more than £50,000, you get nothing. Zero help whatsoever. Not a penny. Whereas there's no upper wage cap on the furlough scheme. There's no upper wage cap on the job support scheme. There's a cap on the amount of money that you can get, but you could be someone earning £250,000 a year and you could get furloughed and you'd still get something. Whereas if you're a self-employed person who's a sole trader who earned more than £50,000, you get nada. I know people in that position who have lost 80% of their income this year. There are people in that position who are the main breadwinner for their family. There are people in that position whose money coming in is absolutely essential for their family finances. And I just find it puzzling that after skipping over those people the first time round, and then having it pointed out that actually this did seem quite unfair, and that the rhetoric around, oh, well, they're probably just these high earners who are, you know, salting money away by being self-employed was incorrect. That the Chancellor, who, to be honest, I think has been one of the people who's come out of this better than anybody else in the government and has not been responsible for any of the fiascos the other idiots have been, such as the testing moronacy, has sort of completely overlooked this one. And he did it again yesterday. So I just find it puzzling. I'd love to hear a proper explanation of it from Rishi, but he's not really been that forthcoming on it. And lots of times people have thought, oh, he's going to help the self-employed. Oh, he's going to help the self-employed. And it never came out. But anyway, the self-employed who have earned less than £50,000 a year and aren't the sort of limited company directors who are not technically self-employed, they're employed by themselves, which there is a slight difference. They're employed by their own company, basically. They are getting some money. It's not a huge amount. They're getting bunged about another £1,800 in grants and they'll get a bit more. But the difference is that a lot of those self-employed people, compared to back in the dark days of full-on lockdown, are now working at the moment. But I would imagine that also a lot of them are looking at the winter ahead and thinking, if we go into full-on lockdown, am I going to be able to work again? Is it going to be another 3 months of me not being able to do my job? So, yeah, it's a tough one. But I'm mystified as to why some of these people continue to be excluded.
Yeah, I think you could say I'm mystified about a fair few things. Also in this winter budget plan thing that we got, winter economy plan, a pay-as-you-grow scheme. So this is basically any businesses that have taken things like the bounce back loan. You have 10 years rather than six to pay it back. It's been extended applications for the business interruption loans, bounce back loans and the like. So you have until November the 30th. It was previously November the 4th. Also VAT deferrals. So those businesses who deferred their VAT payment will now no longer have to pay a lump sum. You can pay in 11 equal parts. Income tax deferral as well, that's in there. You will still have to pay it though, but you've got more time to do so. And the temporary VAT cut extension for those sectors that were worst hit, so the hospitalities and tourism, 15% cut from 20% to 5%. That's being extended now. It was due to expire on January the 12th. You've got longer. It's up to businesses though to pass that on, so don't necessarily believe all those papers and magazines that are saying, hey, much cheaper food and travel, because that may not be passed on at all. But I'm just going to come back finally just to wrap this up, Simon, and just to say, I don't really want to go down that long path of how we're going to pay for it and the disasters and all this sort of thing, but there was a heavy implication within the speech that that taxes have to rise. Do we know any more about that?
We don't quite know about taxes rising yet, which is great, because in the absence of a budget, which would usually give many in the financial industry a nice sort of 2 weeks to a month of putting out press releases speculating on what might happen, we can instead spend those long, dark winter months speculating about what might happen when we get a budget, perhaps in March or something like that, and what tax rises we might get. So we can get more months of speculation. Will CGT go up?
But it's
will pensions
right?
be attacked? Has Boris
inevitable?
Saved the triple lock? Things like that. So, yeah. Ultimately, we're going to have to pay for this somehow, but we can't pay for it all with taxes, because we've spent so much money, it's actually impossible to pay for all of it with taxes. You just completely choke off the recovery. And the idea is that we're just going to somehow magically tax the rich to pay for this. In all honesty, and the IFS has come out and said this repeatedly. The IFS came out and said this before coronavirus. It came out and said it before the last election, that if you want to raise more money in tax, we are at the point now where you're going to have to start raising more money in tax from the general population, i.e. you're going to have to start putting basic rate income tax up, not just higher rate income tax and other things like that. So no, we have no idea how we're going to pay for this. Fortunately, at the moment, we're paying for it with printed money and wide-scale borrowing. But then so is the rest of the world. So right. we're not alone in that boat.
Don't know if that makes me feel any better. I don't think it does. But the question is, are Lee, we going to have Christmas this year? Because the rule of six is a bit difficult for families like mine that are bigger than six. However, it's not just the government measures that may impact on our festivities this year. There's trouble brewing in the ports. Am I right?
That's right, Georgie. So much of the attention in the last sort of week or so has been at Dover, but this is money. We've been having a look at Felixstowe Port, which actually is responsible for nearly half of all imports that come in internationally. So it's a very important port internationally. It's in Suffolk. You know, it's a massive port, and it's privately owned. And what we were told by a company essentially is they were waiting for containers to arrive. They're a seasonal, largely seasonal business. They import their goods September, October, busy times. They get a large amount of containers come in, which they then unload at warehouses and then at their warehouse and then ship off to retailers across the country. Right, so we're talking like some Christmas goods here. The containers haven't arrived and they've been delayed. And they have no idea when these containers are going to arrive. The logistics firm that organises all this, so they organise the freight that comes in, that then comes to the warehouse, have kind of not really given any answers as to where these containers are, what's going on, just saying that there's some problems at Felixstowe. So George Nixon, our reporter, did a bit of digging here. We spoke to the director of the British International Freight Association, which represents about 1,500 companies involved in transporting freight. And he's got worries over what's happened at Felixstowe, saying that potentially it should take around about 48 hours for a container to be turned around, put on a lorry, shipped off and going wherever it's heading. But it's taking up to 10 days at the moment. So that's having huge knock-on effects, almost like a bit of a traffic jam going on at Felixstowe. They can't get these containers out quick enough to make more space for more containers to come in. And other aspects of that, we've been told by logistics firms, is that we've got lorry drivers potentially on furlough. We've got lorry drivers potentially self-isolating. You know, there's been a large increase, I would suggest, of people self-isolating in the last couple of weeks. That's all having an impact. The government social distancing measures that are happening at the port as well are making it slower to turn these containers around. So cleaning them, all of those kind of things. We've spoken to the port and the owners of the port, and they're saying that actually it should take 4.5 days for a container to be turned around, and currently it's at 5 days. So they dispute the claim that it's taking 10 days. But we're seeing that it appears these containers are being delayed, and that's having a huge effect. And this is, you know, coronavirus linked. We've still got Brexit, you know, on the horizon come January. And we actually, George actually contacted the Department for Transport. So as I mentioned previously, it's a privately owned port. But we thought we'd just check with the Department for Transport that it was aware of what was going on. And actually it said it is aware and that it will continue to liaise with the ports and monitor the situation and any impact on wider supply chains. So what the port are telling us is that they're taking on more staff, they're training up more staff to try and get this backlog sort of cleared up. They're saying that there's been a 30% increase in the number of containers that are kind of showing up in the last couple of weeks, and probably a bit of that will be seasonal, so because of Christmas and the festive season coming up, but also probably a backlog from previous months when potentially freight ships weren't coming as frequently because of coronavirus. And it's a situation that we will continue to monitor. We've had a couple of businesses get in touch saying that it's hit them and that they're waiting containers and they're losing business because of a result of this. So if you think about it, if you're a company that imports goods, mm-hmm. And then you're selling them on to retailers, just to say shops, those shops are waiting for those goods from your company, and they're asking where these goods are because they want to sell them to consumers. Now, if you don't have the container in to get these off to lorries to shops, what are you going to do? You don't have the goods to give to the shops. So, you know, that means you might lose business. We've heard examples of some companies could turn around and go, do you know what? Just forget about it. I don't need it now. It's going to come too late. And that kind of thing is, you know, damaging for a business when it's out of your hands. You know, you've got this stuff coming in, you've imported it in, and you can't get it, and you don't know where the whereabouts of it is, and it's just got to be frustrating for small business owners. And if it's hit you, do get in touch with us, editor@thisismoney.co.uk.
Yes, do. Goodness me. Right, we're going to turn our attention to some bad news for savers. It just keeps coming, doesn't it? Trusty NS&I now, they've announced savage cuts to its rates from the end of November, which will hit 25 million customers. It's not just the old hands who've saved with the nation's bank for years and years, but millions of newbies who've signed up for its market-leading accounts since March, when NS&I reversed plan cuts back then to its easy access rates in April. That effectively left it as a best buy destination. What's going on here, Lee?
Georgie, these are probably, I'm going to say, the most brutal savings cuts I've seen in my decade at This Is Money. These are deep, deep rate cuts. And when it landed in my inbox on Monday, I was actually quite blown away at the size and scale of these cuts. So to give a bit of context, NS&I obviously has to act in the best interests of the government and making sure inflows and outflows of cash is right. So a couple of months ago, it turned around and said, we're upping our net financing targets. We're going to take in sort of 35, 40 billion pounds. That's fine. So what's happened is, it's become a default Best Buy, but it's become a default Best Buy in a couple of different categories. People trust NS&I, it's treasury backed, and money that has flowed into both its savings accounts and its premium bonds are just at record highs, billions of pounds going in every month, huge amounts of money. Now, usually, typically, NS&I would be real middle of the road. They'd always be in the middle of our Best Buy tables. You know, they don't ever really want to be the Best Buy. They don't ever really want to be at the bottom. They're finely balanced. They're usually typically middle of the road, right? it's found itself at the top of the Best Buys. People have just piled money in. They had cuts announced, as you say, earlier in the year. And then there was a big hoo-ha, and they decided to reverse those cuts. I kind of wish they stuck to those cuts now, Georgie, because those cuts were far less brutal than what we've seen here. And after they've hoovered up billions of pounds of cash, and this is hoovering up billions of pounds of cash of people who might be new customers, it's not easy opening an S&I account sometimes. You've got to go through all sorts of hoops to get it open. So it's not just a simple process. And people that, as you say, old hands that have had money in there that have decided to up the amount of money they put in there. So let me talk you through some of these cuts, right? So the Direct Saver, this is just a regular easy access account. It pays 1% at the moment, right? Which you think, oh, that doesn't sound much. But it's been a Best Buy, you know, because the easy access rates have been cut elsewhere. That's been cut to 0.1%. From November. And the thing is with it, and why it's popular, not just with ordinary regular savers, but in, you know, investors or people that have got high net wealth, is that you can put £2 million into this account. You can put up to £2 million into the Direct Saver. You know, in a typical bank or building society, you have protection up to £85,000. This, you could put £2 million in. But if you're going to put 2 million quid on, you know, 1% to 0.1%, it ain't good. Income bonds, these have been the cut the most. So these are monthly income bonds. So you put money in and you get a monthly payout from it, right? Monthly savings are very popular with our readership. Unfortunately, there's very, very few places that are kind of doing anything competitive with these. These are going from 1.15% to 0.01%. Oof. It's just as big banks, you know, that's what they're doing at the moment. Again, these could take £1 million in. These income bonds. So again, popular product, regular everyday savers, but also high net wealth people. And some other examples, it's ISA, which, to be honest with you, isn't the greatest because it doesn't accept transfers in anyway. It's dropping from 0.9% to 0.1%. And even children are being hit, Georgie. Poor innocent children on their junior ISAs, down from 3.25% to 1.5%. So that's the regular run-of-the-mill savings accounts that NS&I offer. Brutal cuts, right? Then we go to premium bonds. Now, premium bonds are massively, massively popular, as we know, as we've discussed on the show many a time. And billions of pounds have gone into premium bonds this year. You know, people see it as a safe haven. They see it as somewhere to park their cash. At the moment, it has an underlying rate of 1.4%. That's the typical amount of money you would earn over a year, but we know it doesn't work like that because there's years that you won't win prizes and there's years that you might win big prizes, right? The odds for winning anything in the premium bonds now going up from 24,500 to 1 to 34,500 to 1. Underlying rates going to 1%, which actually, when you think about that, is not as brutal as the cuts on the rest of its savings rates, to be quite frank. There's still going to be two top prizes each month of £1 million. But the number of £25,000 prizes, for example, is going to be nearly halved. There's currently 700,000 pound prizes. That's going to drop to 4. They're just not going to look as attractive as they are at the moment. And, you know, it's up to people whether you could get angry about this. You could be like, I've just put my money in there a couple of weeks ago. Oh, now what am I going to do with my money? Yeah. And unfortunately, I think there's such little options out there, really, that I kind of make people go, oh, yeah, okay, well, maybe I will move my money to get this other 1% easy access account. You know, my worry is people are just going to simply go, do you know what? It's not worth the rip roll. Can't be bothered with it. And I know my money's safe in NS&I and it's just going to have to suck it up. But you've got to look into this. You've got to see if this how this works for you and whether or not you're happy that NS&I have made these brutal cuts. And as I say, Georgie, look, decisions have to be made. Tough decisions have to be made. But these are such deep cuts. And why it couldn't have just done a more of a step-by-step approach, you know, like that, the April-May cuts that they had initially penciled in. As I say, that cut would have made these look generous. You know what I mean? Incredible stuff. And yeah, there are options. You can move elsewhere. I'm not going to list off all the banks and building sites that are offering better rates just because these are chop and change all the time. But you can still get a percent or more on easy access if you want to. There's still some ISAs out there that are offering a bit more money. If you've got a junior ISA for your child, there's some better rates out there, much better rates than the 1.5% that's going to be on offer. My gut instinct when we see figures later in the year of the, you know, I was talking about the net financing earlier, about the incomings and outgoings. my gut instinct is the amount of outgoings compared to the ingoings for this financial year, the amount of money that it would have poured in is going to be far, far, far higher than the money that's pulled out from people angry about this.
Yeah, you're right. Where to go? We are up to date. You guys are up to date on thisismoney.co.uk. Best buys, do take a look there. But yeah, I think you might be right, and people will just stick. One area where people sticking really hammered them, as we know, is when it came to insurance. However, that may not go on for much longer. It's after the city watchdog got involved, after This Is Money have been banging on about it for a fair few years. And it's published proposals that could save some 6 million customers 3.7 billion over 10 years due to the loyalty penalty. Simon, how did we get into this situation? I thought loyalty paid. And isn't it even cheaper for customers just to be nice to the ones they've got rather than spend all their money on marketing and trying to hook in new people?
No, loyalty doesn't pay with your insurer. Anybody who thinks that is being mugged off. Your insurance just goes up every year. They just ratchet it up and they ratchet up and they ratchet up. And then when you go and compare prices, you quite often find that you get a cheaper deal from your insurer. And then you phone up your insurer and tell them this and they go, oh yeah, that's the rate for new customers. It's like, well, what about us existing customers, eh? And insurers have a habit of doing this. They've had a habit of doing this for years. They do it on home insurance. They do it on car insurance. They'll do it in many places they possibly can. And it's not just insurers. You'll find that you'll find your broadband goes up each year and you could probably get a better deal as a new customer. Anyway, there's been a consumer complaint. There's been the watchdog looking into it. And they've discovered something, as you said, that we've known for years. There's no reward for being loyal. There's just a penalty. So there is potentially going to be a ban on the loyalty penalty because it hits the people who are less savvy more than others. So if you're savvy and you switch around all the time, then you probably won't get caught out. I don't think I've been insured with the same car insurer 2 years in a row on our family car. Well, God knows how long that's been. But if you are a new customer, you pay on average £285 for your car insurance. If you're a loyal customer, been there for more than 5 years, you pay on average £370. It's quite clear in the numbers. So the watchdog has proposed that customers who renew their home or motor insurance policy should pay no more than they would if they were new to their provider through the same sales channel. Expect lots of jiggery pokery from insurers to try and do that, work out what the same sales channel is and exactly how they can do it. And the bad news is really for anybody who does actually compare their insurance each year is that they're probably going to find out that their insurance actually starts getting more expensive because everybody else, the people who don't change every year, are going to be getting a fairer deal. But I guess we have to look at this and say, why are people being mugged off to such a great extent? And is that right? And should it just be that a savvy few are getting a good deal and the rest aren't? And the FCA is finally stepping in to do something about this. But I would advise anybody who has insurance to keep checking the prices, keep doing comparisons and everything like that, because these things move slowly. And you will not find that all of a sudden the loyalty penalty is removed. I would imagine if it actually ever is, it would take some time for it to happen.
I do wonder, Simon, what impact this will have, just briefly, on comparison sites. Because I wonder if that sort of changed the model of this sort of race to the bottom. And they have done a relatively good job in terms of making sure that insurers keep on their toes. But also the flip side of that is it's hollowed out the product just so they can offer really cheap products go to the top of the table. And we have this situation of loyalty doesn't pay. So I wonder what's going to change to the model, if anything, do you think? Is there going to be a space for comparison sites in the future?
Well, the rise of the comparison site has probably made this worse. There is probably something in that argument that is put forward, is that basically the ability, the price discovery mechanism for people in the know has got much, much more efficient. So it's much easier to find the cheapest possible person. So in order to compete against those cheapest possible prices, companies have to pull their money in elsewhere if they want to maintain their profits. And so they are pulling in the money from the people who don't compare. I don't think that this is going to kill off the comparison industry in any way, because still, firstly, it's still a good idea to check. And secondly, this predates the comparison industry. I am old enough to remember having to phone around car insurers to do this where you'd have to phone about five different insurers and go through the rigmarole and then phone your own insurer back and say, well, I spoke to this company and they offered me this. And then the person on the phone would say, okay, well, we'll offer you that. And it was 30 quid cheaper or something like that. You didn't have the same kind of price comparison engine scenario that you have now when you had to do that. And the insurers were still ripping people off with the loyalty penalty. So you can't just blame the price comparison sites. And I think there will definitely remain a place for them. Maybe the ripoff will just get slightly not as bad.
Slightly not as bad. All right, let's hope not. To our final piece here. And I say this as someone that made a large purchase during lockdown that I now feel might have been a bit premature. The cross trainer that's now in my living room. Don't know what the hell I'm going to do with that. But I'm not the only one who made big purchases. And Lee and Simon, you did a fantastic piece of investigative journalism about hot tubs. Yeah, we're back with hot tubs. We reported on the huge rise, if you remember, podcast past, in sales during lockdown. Alas, it's a Less P. Diddy music video with flowing champers, as actually hundreds of buyers have complained about faults and not receiving refunds. The dream turns sourly.
I don't know if P. Diddy has a hot tub or if he's had any problems with his hot tub, whether he had problems getting it repaired, but I would have thought that P. Diddy would have a hot tub guy on speed dial to fix his. That's right. When, again, reporter George Nixon filed this earlier in the week, my reaction was, please make this the last hot tub story of the year. And he told me it will be. This is the end. This is the natural progression. The weather's turning and there will be no more hot tub stories on This Is Money until it resurfaces next year. Mm-hmm. What we've been told by the company Resolver is that it's had a massive uptick in people complaining about faulty hot tubs. That is lights not working, leaks, that kind of thing. An actual difficulty then either getting the money back or most people just want to have it repaired. If there's a couple of lights not working in your hot tub, you know, it's frustrating because you want it all lit up and looking good, and you know, especially for the gram, for Instagram photos. And if those lights aren't working, why can't someone just come out and fix it? And that's issues that we've had, we've reported on in the past. And of course, we've had a massive uptick in people complaining about, or not complaining, actually just reporting scams. You know, transferring money to people who are reportedly selling hot tubs and of course aren't actually selling hot tubs and just run off with your cash. So hot tubs have been a pretty popular lockdown purchase. I mean, I would have thought the market for them now is going to be pretty low compared to say April when the weather was getting good and people were going, oh, hold on a minute, I'm going to be trapped indoors for quite some time here, might as well, you know, make the garden a bit more exciting with a hot tub. I've got my travel refund, I'm not going on a juicy holiday, maybe a hot tub, I'm going to treat myself to one. But it can go wrong, and if you buy from a third party seller, it could be even more difficult. So if you're buying through somewhere like eBay, it becomes a bit murky as to who's responsible for the repair work or a refund. So if you bought directly from a hot tub manufacturer, it probably would be a lot easier. But the trouble is, they sold out so quickly and they weren't taking on any more orders. So what people then naturally do is think, well, you know, get one off eBay, for example. If it's come perhaps secondhand, or even if it just comes from a seller brand new, we had a case where the guy just couldn't get it fixed, bought it for eBay and washed their hands of it. The seller washed their hands of it, refused to come and fix basically what seemed like quite a simple problem. Lights weren't working. So I said to George, people have had enough of hot tub stories now. This is it. This is the end. No more. And then lo and behold, it gets to the end of the day when the story was published and it was pretty much the most read story of the day. The amount of Google traffic it did with the kicker hot tub damage probably shows that there's quite a lot of people in the same boat or in the same spa, you know. So it's a problem, Georgie. If you've got hot tub woes, if you regret your hot tub purchase or any other kind of purchase during lockdown, it's become a bit of a white elephant either in your garden or as your cross trainer shows in your living room, please get in touch with us, editor@thisismoney.co.uk. We'd love to hear your stories.
Yeah, and if anyone's in the market for a cross trainer, please do get in contact. I'm on Twitter. You know, I'll do you a good deal. Yeah. Do you a good deal. Anyway, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, if you'd like to buy my cross trainer, or you have a problem with a hot tub, Simon.
Or you'd like to tell us how you can put a cross trainer in a hot tub in order to provide a more environmentally friendly solution. Yes, email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. As Lee just said, don't put cross trainers in hot tubs. Cross trainers are electric and hot tubs are water, by the way, people.
I don't think mine is electric, you know. Or maybe it is. I don't know. Carry on, Simon.
It's definitely got electronics in it, Georgie. I reckon it's definitely got electronics in it. Don't put it in a hot tub. Okay. Yes, or tweet us at thisismoney.co.uk or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read comments.
Indeed, do. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us. The This Is Money podcast is brought to you with Charles Stanley Direct. Open an account today and start saving for your future. Investment involves risk.